You're listening to KZSU Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for listening today. Today, I'm very pleased to have on a guest who will be slightly different than many of the guests that I've had on the show thus far. The reason is Alyssa Hecker is, aside from being a good friend of mine, which also differentiates her from most of the guests I've had on, is someone who has very, very interesting experience in the world of entertainment. We are going to be discussing today various issues and kind of current problems and debates that are existing in the world of copyright. And Alyssa's background is somewhat similar to mine, but also gives us an opportunity to kind of debate and discuss some of the issues involving copyright, both from a music perspective, everything from mashups to podcasting to music licensing and issues of that nature. Alyssa Hecker is currently running her own law practice in New York, and I'll let her talk about that as well. Prior to opening up her law office, she was an associate counsel and a director of anti-piracy efforts for the Harry Fox Agency, which is a music licensing organization that is heavily involved, along with other organizations, in a lot of the issues involved in copyright disputes. So Alyssa is a terrific guest to have on to discuss the myriad issues that come up when dealing with issues of piracy and music copywriting and licensing and fair use and all of these really fascinating issues that are currently being debated and discussed and really ultimately solved at some point by lawyers and academics and people in the music business and artists and what have you. So I'm very excited to have Alyssa on today to discuss these issues. We're also going to be discussing the issue of orphan works, which is something that's come up repeatedly on this show. I've touched on it with a number of people, including Chris Sprigman a few weeks ago, as well as Elizabeth Gard, both of whom have looked at this issue and written on it. And I'm excited to get Alyssa's perspective not only on the issue itself, but also on the currently being debated legislation that would attempt to, at least in one way or another, solve or address the problem. So we have a pretty wide-ranging collection of issues to discuss today, and I'm looking forward to talking to Alyssa. So we're going to take another short music break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Alyssa Hecker. So if I've done my job properly, on the other end of the microphone is Alyssa. Alyssa, are you there?
I am.
Terrific. Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you.
And why don't we dive right in and first talk about music licensing? And I think the opening question that I should ask is, why don't you describe for listeners your background and how you came to getting involved in these issues?
Sure. Well, I spent almost 10 years in the music industry working, as David had said, in the Harry Fox Agency, which is the licensing clearinghouse and its parent company, the National Music Publishers Association, which is the trade association for music publishers in the United States. When a songwriter, for example, writes to start at the very beginning, writes a song, you have the what's called the underlying musical composition, and you've got the words. Very often, there's a pair of songwriters, or one songwriter may write it. Then the songwriter very often sells the rights or licenses the rights to a publisher, which tries to get the song out in the public.
So the licensing process that you're involved with is really is the back room efforts to get permission to use works and to do whatever you want with them.
Correct. If anybody wants to put out an album, and there's a work that's been previously published for public consumption, you can get what is called a compulsory license, which is under Section 115 of the Copyright Act, which means you can basically make a cover for any song, include, you know, that obviously has nothing to do with the master rights, which we can talk about. But for the publisher, you can license it, you can put out an album, as long as you're paying the statutory rate and you have your licenses, then you can go do that.
There are so many different types of licenses, and I think it confuses a lot of people, even people who are attorneys, figuring out which license applies. One license that comes up off, well, two, is the mechanical license and synchronization license, or the sync license. Can you just run through in a couple of minutes kind of these different types of licenses and generally what they mean?
Sure. A mechanical license is a license that is issued under the Section 115 compulsory license that I just mentioned. That's for the use on what is defined in the Copyright Act as phono records. That would be CDs, that would be DVDs only if they're an audio DVD, some full digital downloads, the DPDs, any tapes, any kind of phono record audio, hard copy something. And that falls under the compulsory license, and that's a statutory rate, which at this point is, I believe, 0.91 cents for up to 5 minutes, and if it's above that, it's 0.175 cents. If you have a synchronization, that's if you have an audio-visual, and that's always a negotiated rate. So that's if you go to the movies, if you see a television commercial, if you're watching a TV show, anything like that, and very often some of the Internet uses, that is negotiated. That is not statutorily set, so the copyright owner can set pretty much whatever he or she wants to and can also say no to the use. Whereas with a compulsory license, the licensor cannot say no to the use as long as it's licensed properly.
Okay.
Hence the term compulsory.
The licensing organizations, I know Harry Fox is one and there are others, but to just get an idea, how much work, how much material are we talking about that's that is in one way or another licensed by, or the managing of the licensing, I should say, occurs with these organizations?
Well, I know that Harry Fox represents about 80% of the market in the United States, mm-hmm. I believe well over 100,000 songs, if not more than that. I mean, everything you listen to or you see pretty much has music attached to it. You may not even realize it, but if you've got music in the elevator, if you've got music on television, music on the radio, anytime you hear some sort of music in the public, it should be licensed some way, whether it be through Harry Fox directly, if it's a public performance through the PROs, which are the Performing Rights Societies, or organizations and things like that. So I can't give you a number. It's just
I wasn't looking for a specific, but it's a vast majority of the work that's out there.
Yes.
So you're in practice now on your own, doing the very brave. I've always admired attorneys that do this. The very brave solo practitioner. And your clients represent a large spectrum of the entertainment world. I'm curious, before we get into some of the issues, you're also the immediate past president of the Entertainment Arts and Sports Law Section of NISBA, the New York State Bar Association. And I've had the pleasure of having some articles published in the journal there, as you know. What's your sense, just in a broad level, about the awareness that people have? And I'm talking not only about the entertainment industry, obviously would be aware of it, but just generally, when you when you have the opportunity to discuss these issues, both even in the section of NISBA that you're involved with, but others, what's your sense of people's understanding of music licensing and these copyright issues?
That's a very good question. One of my main missions, and working with the Copyright Society or with the EASL section, is education, because very often, even attorneys who practice in the area, let alone the general public, have no concept of what goes on. You hear music, and it sounds like it's ephemeral. It's out there. Why can't I use it? I can hear it on the radio. Why can't I just use it for anything I want to? And something that I've encountered a lot, particularly going into schools and talking to students, whether it be kindergarten through college, and a lot of teachers as well, because everything is so easily copied now, and because I buy something, therefore I must own it, people just... not even that they don't understand, they don't know that there really is something out there. And a big issue that comes up is nobody knows about the copyright law per se, but everybody knows the words fair use.
Right.
And it's an interesting thing to talk to people to explain, fair use is really a defense to a copyright infringement lawsuit rather than an affirmative statement that you can make.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, that's the kind of thing that I see a lot. There is a lot of confusion in terms of, why do I need a license? Why do I have to pay for this? I'm not making money off of this. I'm floating my favorite songs up to my website to share with the world. Why is that wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a huge educational push to not only not turn people off, because obviously we don't want people to be sued. We don't want people to go to jail, because people are not aware, particularly on the Internet, that it's a criminal penalty as well as a civil penalty for monetary damages if you do use someone else's work without permission willfully.
The issues often turn, I think, on this distinction between fair use and piracy, and maybe that your discussion there would be a good entree into turning to the issue of fair use. I found, coming from, you know, the perspective of, you know, working on these issues at the Center for Internet and Society and you know, largely being involved in issues involving music copyright, that there is often the belief that if you are in support of a strong version of fair use, and we can talk about that in a moment as well, but if you're in support of a fair use doctrine that is more expansive than it is now, let's put it that way, that you also, therefore, believe that piracy is okay. The idea of theft, the idea of taking a work that is not yours and just copying it and distributing it either on the internet or selling it or what have you. And the truth of the matter is that there are always fringe elements in any group of people who may go further, but the general mainstream position with regard to copyright law, from the perspective of people that are working on having a more expansive version of fair use, is one that fully recognizes the need for copyright, and that recognizes that creators of work should be able to capture the economic benefits of what that which they create. When you talk to people, are you finding that people are so confused on the issue or so ill-informed or just unaware that they believe that that piracy and fair use are one and the same?
Not so much. I mean, as you know, I've obviously I'm very familiar with the expanded fair use contingency, which to me is the fringe.
Well, and that's what we'll talk about today.
It really comes to be people know the word fair use because they've seen it, and you'll see that on pretty much every website that this is a fair use, blah, 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 for educational purposes, but people don't really know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that people say fair use and therefore, you know, across the board, whatever. They just think that it means it's okay. I think they equate, a lot of people equate fair use to public domain if we're going to use a specific definition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that, no, you know, the people who are using it don't know the law, don't know the definitions, and they just say, if I put this on my website, for example, if I put this on my CD, or if I'm using this in a talk, for example, that's, you know, doesn't qualify under the fair use definition, should that person be sued, then they feel, well, we could just do it, we're kind of safeguarded, because we've used those two words.
So they use the word fair use as kind of a rubber stamp for all, yeah, any and all activities.
Yeah, because that's what they see other people doing. You know, mm-hmm. It just seems to be, well, he's doing it, so therefore it must be okay.
Right, right. Well, let's, you've opened up the discussion, and so why don't we get right into it? So give me your perspective on, and I should emphasize to the listeners that you're speaking on behalf of yourself only. You're not speaking on behalf of any other organization.
Right.
And I should also say again, just so that it's clear, to the listeners, I said at the beginning, but Alyssa is someone that, I know personally, as a friend of mine. Having said that, those are often the most fun discussions to, discuss these things with friends. So just wanted to mention those couple of things. So let's turn to the fair use issue. So what is your definition or what would be your parameters of a properly functioning fair use doctrine?
The way it is now,
which to you it means what? How do you define it as it exists today?
Well, I mean, I don't have the specific definition.
No, I'm not. Again, I'm speaking in generalities.
You know, if you need to give handouts in a classroom, for example, and you know, or everything is being done online now, so I guess fair use really has to be modeled with what's going on online. If you have a class and you have students copying, you know, say your book that you put online, or someone else's book, but they can't copy it, they can't take it with us, they can't do other things. I think for educational purposes, for example, that's fair use.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the newsworthy is fair use. I think it's easier for me to define what's not fair use.
Sure.
Which is just the taking without permission of somebody else's copyrighted work.
Mm-hmm. And the people, so I don't know that anything you said is particularly, it certainly doesn't sound controversial to me, but what are you coming across out there that would suggest that definition is somehow not enough for some people? Well, what are you finding?
People resent the fact that they either have to ask permission or pay for something. And the, you know, as you know, the basis of the Copyright Act was the economic incentive to have creators create and be free to create without the frustration of having to have a separate living to make money. And oftentimes people think about, you know, fair use and I'm taking songs. They think of the big record companies. They think of the multi-platinum album. They don't think about starving artists. They don't think about the individual songwriters. They don't think about the photographers who, they just don't think about the people who have to pay an extraordinary amount of money or, you know, even just to create their work or even the people who have to send their kids to college, pay for their electricity, you know, their electricity or anything like that. And It wouldn't cross anybody's mind. Again, I'm using music because that's my background. I think that's one of the easiest things to use it as an example.
Right.
Because everybody hears music all the time. If it's out there, why can't I use it? You know, and why do I have to pay six different people or organizations and, you know, get clearances just to use it if I want to do something, even if I don't make money with it? And that's the biggest thing. If people are not making money off of use to someone else's copyrighted work, there is a huge fight to say, well, why should I pay you money? All you did was create it, but it's out there now, so it's mine.
Do you draw a distinction in your own thinking about this stuff between an entire use of a work? In other words, if I take a song and I just copy it and use it in a way that, let's assume for the moment, would generally fall under a definition of fair use versus using an excerpt of a recording. Do you think that there is or should be a distinction between those two?
I've got to answer your question like a lawyer and say it depends.
Sure. No, as an attorney, I would expect nothing less.
It really depends on the use. If it does fall under what would be the defense of fair use at this point, like if there is nothing in the courts at this point to say whether a 5-second snippet in a song, for example, like a sample, or, you know, a 20-minute, it's the heart of the work, is it not? It's really difficult to determine if, for example, I mean, I had a recent case where it was a major kind of PlayStation game, and there was a sample contained in one of the songs of the PlayStation game, and the question was is this fair use? Is it de minimis use? If there was no permission, because it's such a tiny, tiny part of the game. But on the other side, you know, the people who created the initial stuff were never consulted, there were no licenses paid, and they see now that millions of copies are being sold at PlayStation, and their song's in there. So to them, it's not a fair use, and I don't think it would be fair to say this may be a fair use, this may not be, because there are so many different media and so many different intellectual properties out there that if you make a definition that is black and white on paper, somebody's going to be left out, and it's not going to be fair.
There's a famous example that that often comes up in these discussions, and Professor Lessig brings it up when he discusses fair use, and others do, and I'll throw it out there. It's one I'm sure you're familiar with, and I've mentioned it on the show previously, but it's the Outkast Hey Ya Peanuts mashup. And what it effectively is a video that uses the song Hey Ya by Outkast, the popular song of, you know, last year, I guess, 2 years ago, and merges that music with snippets of a Peanuts cartoon. And what it appears as a result is that the Peanuts characters are dancing and playing to this song. And it was distributed on on the internet and was made popular that way. Without seeing it, I you know, one of the limitations of this medium, of course, is that I can't play video. But, and obviously playing the song wouldn't do anything for anyone. So, describing it that way, what's your reaction to it? Should that be something, you know, the creation of this new artistic work using what are copyrighted materials? That is the snippets of the Peanuts song, and I think most of, at least in the version I've seen, most of, perhaps not all, of the Outkast song. Should that be fair use? What's your sense of that?
You know what? As soon as I heard about that and then repeating it now, it's derivative work. You're using original copyrighted works that are out there to make a new work based on those. It doesn't fall under a parody, under a fair use exception. And I think that anything taken from the original is a derivative and requires permission.
So even where it's creating something that is a new work in and of itself.
But you're trying to get this as a transformative work.
Well, yeah, I mean, effectively, I would argue that at the end of the day, it is a new work. And in that sense, and I'm using slightly more general terms for the audience,
right.
But yes, I mean, the legal term for what I'm describing is transformative. I would argue that that piece of work, however you define it, is something which is a new creation, and that the use of that video combined with that music is something which is different than simply copying the video and playing it with the original sound of, you know, the Peanuts characters, or similarly just copying the song by Outkast and putting it out there. So yes, that would certainly be my position. But this is where the debate lies.
Right.
And I think it's, you know, one of the interesting issues that come up here. And my goal here, of course, is not to convince you otherwise. nor is the goal of this show to convince anyone of anything. It's really more a matter of discussing the issues, which is why I'm excited to have you on today. But I think a lot of what this turns on and what you were saying kind of points me back to my kind of original proposition, which is that in any issue, you have situations where one can take a position and extend it and make it into something else. And I personally think and I understand your experience, you know, may be different, but I do think that there is a wide range of opinion within the group of people that are seeking to, you know, liberalize or expand fair use, or in the way I would characterize it, frankly, is to merely enforce it the way it was intended to be enforced. And that's a debate that's neither here nor there. I understand that there are different positions on that as well. But at the end of the day, it seems to me that you're still dealing with a dichotomy between those that want to to use your phrase, maybe just don't understand copyright and don't understand why they need permission, and therefore just want to have the benefit of just taking anything and using it however they want, and people that are really trying to do something which would fall under First Amendment protections.
There's an issue, because copyright and First Amendment are two entirely different things.
Okay.
And one is economic and one is freedom of speech.
So why don't you talk to me
about
that?
There's a real dichotomy there.
Go ahead. I mean,
you raised the hair on the back of my neck on that one.
Good. This is a good discussion.
They're made for two totally different purposes. The Copyright Act in the United States, this is obviously Europe notwithstanding and other areas of the world, is purely economic. The First Amendment has nothing to do with that. And freedom of speech and economics can come to a loggerhead at some point, because sometimes it's just commerce.
Right.
And freedom of speech is different. It is not. I don't believe that there is really a melding of the two, or should there be a melding of the two? I mean, there was Martin Luther King Jr., for example, had the freedom of speech to make his speeches, but his speeches are owned by his estate, and it's as part of his legacy. People can't just, unless obviously the copyright owners now allow them to, and again, licensing is not always a monetary thing. If a copyright owner wants to license for gratis, for example, which means at no cost, that's the owner's right to use. But it just burns me, because if you don't own something and you don't have the right to use it, then you really shouldn't use it for your purposes just because you want to.
Do you think that there should be a public concern exception when it comes to copyright? Go ahead.
The public is taken into consideration. I will not disagree with you when you say, for example, is it difficult to license? Could there be easier ways? Yes. And I know some people are trying to remedy that with the orphan work situation. I don't necessarily agree with the legislation per se, but...
And we'll talk about that after the music break.
There are some things out there. It's not easy, particularly if you have like 9 owners. But at the same time, the public, you know, the quote public exception is still stealing. If you have an exception, you open the floodgates and people can just take things, then the artist loses the economic incentive to create, has to take a job, has to do other things, has no time to create. I mean, again, you have to remember that the artists are very often getting a pittance, and I'll talk about the music again. The music songwriters and publishers, for example, for every album that's manufactured and distributed, they get 9 cents per use per song. They are not breaking the bank here. And for someone to complain about, you know, I can make however much on an album, and then, oh, you have to buy it in the store. Yes, they may be too expensive. I mean, that's something altogether different in terms of pricing. But when it comes down to it fundamentally, the creator, in my opinion, most often gets screwed economically. And if you make, you know, a public exception, I think the public's going to suffer, because you're not going to have the same kind of creativity, and you're going to lose the incentive to create.
The you know, it's, you take something like, take someone like a documentary filmmaker, mm-hmm. someone who's trying to, you know, expose, we'll take something like, you know, expose a something that they deem to be a wrong or something that they think hasn't been adequately covered in the press. I take it you're not suggesting that that documentary filmmaker would be required to seek permission from any copyright or trademark holder, for that matter, or any intellectual rights holder of any information that they would try to use to tell their story. In other words, I take it you would not suggest that, not that they shouldn't ask for permission, but that if they don't get permission, that the fair use issue wouldn't come up and be a way for them to get around the possibility that a copyright or trademark holder would be able to prevent the dissemination of newsworthy information.
Well, listen, it depends. If you've mm-hmm. got a representative of the KKK, for example, putting together a documentary wanting to use footage has been denied or doesn't ask, and that's being used to promote the KKK beliefs, I think that like a major network or someone from whom footage may have been taken or an estate of someone might have a problem with that and should have all sorts of remedies to get that stopped.
Well, you could take an example like that, but it goes both ways. I mean, regardless of the motivation of the documentary filmmaker using that example, there's still an issue of someone being able to use intellectual property rights to stifle speech. And I guess I'm just trying to understand the parameters that you would set. If the First Amendment is not part of any analysis in copyright law, then where are we left with someone that wants to use copyrighted materials in a way that's newsworthy?
Well, copyrighted materials aside, there's a lot of, particularly in documentary films, public domain works for which you don't need permission.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously a vast trove out there.
Right.
But I would never set parameters, because like I said earlier, I think that you can hurt parties that you don't anticipate hurting down the line by setting parameters. I think that in certain documentaries, depending on how they're done, for example, the audience, just depending on the situation, there may be ways, but I also think it doesn't hurt across the board as a good general practice to try to obtain permission. And again, documentaries very often get gratis permission.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the paperwork. Good filmmakers will do that to make sure they're covered. And they have the paperwork without necessarily having to pay an arm and a leg
mm-hmm.
to use it.
Fair enough. Well, this is, you know, these are the fun discussions. I'm glad that, I'm glad to have a spirited discussion about this stuff on the show.
Can I just do a quick jump in?
Oh, yeah, please.
Plug, about, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, a group of us got together with the Copyright Society and worked on FACE, Friends of Active Copyright Education, which is part of the Copyright Society of the USA's website. On it, we created a very easy, very, very user-friendly part of the website called copyrightkids.org. And that's walking through a group of students, I believe we did it in the middle school, high school level, how to make a multimedia yearbook. And we walk through, and it's a cute kind of cartoon thing. It's interactive. And for people who don't really understand licensing and copyright, and it's not one side or the other, it's just basically what is there now, it's a good way to understand what is fair use, what can I use, what can't I use, what, you know, if I use a movie, if I use this, if I use a clip of that. And it's a really, really good way to understand what it is in terms of copyright.
And where can they access that again?
It's copyrightkids.org.
Okay. Is that one word? Okay, great. Well, that's a great resource. To get the myriad of perspectives on this stuff, I think it's important to get out there and learn. And, that sounds like, I'm not familiar with it, but that sounds like it would be a great place to start. Why don't we take a short music break? Somewhat ironically, short music break, which is fully licensed. And when we return, we could go on for quite a while on fair use, but I do want to turn to orphan works and one or two other topics before we run out of time. So you're listening to David Levine on Hearsay Culture with my guest Alyssa Hecker. When we return from the music, we'll continue the discussion. That's the great Mary Amsterberg. Speaking of artists that that don't get a lot of airplay, unfortunately, Mary Amsterberg with a U AMSDRBURG, and her song Design. Very pleased to be able to play some musicians that I've love and don't get enough airplay. In my effort to help promote some workers in the music business that hopefully will, with further recognition, be able to create more. So I've actually, Alyssa's mic is not actually on right now, and so I'm using my censorship rights to some degree. I will turn the mic on so that I don't appear to be dictatorial in running my show.
Okay, the gag has been removed.
Exactly, yeah, I removed the gag. But before we continue the discussion, I just want to do what I do at the bottom of the hour of every show that I've done in the last several months, which is to ask you if you like what you're hearing. And that could mean anything from liking the show to liking Alyssa more than me, or me more than Alyssa, whatever you like, as long as you like something about the show. I'm going to ask you to help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area, as well as on the internet through kzsu.stanford.edu. So I'm asking for money and asking you to donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And don't forget to keep on listening. So, Alyssa, we're back. And let's turn to the Orphan Works issue, because in the time we have left, that's also a complicated issue, and I want to get your perspective on it. So, again, I've discussed Orphan Works on this show previously, but to sum it up very quickly, they're works that, for one reason or another, are either difficult or impossible to locate the copyright owners, thus leaving, in many people's perspective, the copyrighted work in limbo and unavailable to the public for any use, fair use or otherwise, because of the difficulty in finding the owner. Why don't you offer your perspective on the Orphan Works issue and on where we are right now on it?
I completely agree that there's a problem. Let me start by saying there is a problem.
So there is some agreement.
There is agreement there. I'm not sure that the proposed legislation is the answer.
Okay.
A real concern of mine is that somebody will circumvent the Copyright Act by using the Orphan Works whatever legislation passes, as an excuse to circumvent it, or it might go back to the days, and this you can probably see reflected in a lot of the comments filed by very many of the trade associations with the Copyright Office, that they might reinstitute the registration requirement for copyright, and that's very burdensome, onerous, and it was done away with because it was, people were losing their copyrights because they hadn't registered properly. So those are two things.
I think formalities, that what, when you talk about the registration, the term often uses formalities. There were reasons for getting rid of it. And, you know, you take a look at state copyright law, for example, which, as you know, covers all sound recordings made prior to 1972. And most states, if not all, I don't know all 50 states, but I'm not aware of a state that has a formal registration process for getting copyright protection. What the alternatives often are, and certainly I had Chris Sprigman on, professor from University of Virginia, who's written a law review article in Stanford Law Review called Reformalizing Copyright, effectively arguing that formality should return. What, how do you get at the issue, if you can't find the copyright owner?
Well, I think one of the organizations, I'm trying to remember which one, I think it was ASMP, which is the Association of Media Photographers, proposed that there be an Orphan Works kind of license fee that's paid through to the Copyright Office, and should the owner, you know, eventually be discovered, because due diligence is obviously the question of what will the definition of due diligence mean, but should somebody come forth who is actually a copyright owner, that entity not be, you know, not lose out, not lose the copyright in effect, but that license fee would be held, and that if it no longer becomes an orphan work, for example, that entity would be compensated.
Mm-hmm. And
I think that was one of the good proposals. Sorry.
I interrupted you. The Orphan Works issue also tends to be something that people think about when they're dealing with works that are old. Old meanings, you know, recordings made, you know, let's say prior to 1940. I'm curious your sense in the Orphan Works issue about how big a problem you think it is. Is it narrowly focused to older recordings? Do you think it's a bigger issue than that? What's your sense of it?
A lot of this came up in the fact of documentaries. I think that it affects it in a huge way. I think it's definitely some older things, but it's not too many older things because, like I said earlier, a lot of stuff is in the public domain. I mean, obviously, anything I think is prior now to 1919 or 1921. I don't remember the exact date. So you're looking at a gap of maybe 20 years, which is not that much, relatively speaking. I don't have, again, the numbers or the comprehension of how big an issue it is. I know it's big enough that a lot of trade organizations for photographers and the music publishers and the movies, you know, things like that, a lot of them are filing against having legislation for orphan works. And a lot of these entities are the ones who use the works that are considered orphan works. But I can't gauge the specificity of how many are out there.
Do you suspect, maybe I'll ask you to do the crystal ball thing, which whenever I ask that question, I always, you know, think about how much I hated getting a question like that when I was a litigator. People want to know if they're going to win, and the answer, of course, is right. I don't have a crystal ball. So with that caveat, what's your sense of do you have a sense of what's likely to happen as far as legislation on this issue?
I don't, only because this is also combined with a bill for music licensing and some other things. It's a multi-part bill, and I know that there's a lot of controversy both for the orphan rights and for the issues of licensing. So I don't know if it would go ahead, or if it does, how soon, or if this was just an issue that was brought up because it's interim elections. I know something has to be done, but I don't know if this is the way.
Mm-hmm. You think what would be a better way in your view to deal with it?
You know what, I'm thinking, as I'm saying that, I don't know. I think this might be better. This would definitely be better than litigation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think there needs to be legislation, but I think more time needs to be spent reviewing the comments and having some testimony from different interest groups, and possibly drafting it after an election term.
Right. Yeah, that's, I think what we're finding now, certainly within the lead up to the election, is that there is quite a bit going on out there, which is being tucked in other bills. Nothing to do with this topic, but, one of my areas of, that I focused on is the legality of online gaming. This show is being recorded on October 20th. And so it was last week that the president signed a bill which effectively ended online gaming in any legal form in the United States, and it was tucked into a bill dealing with port security. So there's a lot going on in Congress which isn't getting the necessarily full attention. Let me turn to, in the remaining minutes that we have, something that we discussed a little bit earlier, but I want to touch a little more on, which is the cost of music licensing. There's often an issue involving how much a particular owner of a copyright will ask for use, that is permission, to use a snippet of work. And there are stories, you know, anecdotal, you know, I think at this point, but stories of, particular artists or television networks or what have you asking for a $10,000 fee to use 5 seconds of a particular show that's sitting in the background of a film. What is your sense of the cost of music licensing? Is it an issue out there? Is it something that you think about?
Something I think about?
Something you think about.
My clients are concerned.
Yeah, well, both. I mean, is it something which you find comes up as a bone of contention in your practice?
Not really a bone of contention, but then again, there are so many different things. Like I said, you've got the compulsory rate, so that's not an issue. If you're going to put out an album or a phono record, you're only paying 9 cents per use. So that's not and it goes up every 2 years, it goes up incrementally. For the master right, it shouldn't be that much. Anything, any synchronization right is, and I think that's what you're more concerned with, the synchronization right, or,
right.
You know, if you've got live concerts, how much would you charge per ticket?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the negotiating rights. Obviously, the music, the copyright owners can't fix rates. That would be antitrust issues. I think that there's a lot of arguments that, you know what, CDs are really expensive. For what it costs to create them, do I like going and spending $20 for a CD when I know what they actually pay the publishers, the songwriters, and the artists? No. I think it's absurd. I think it costs them nothing, and something should be done about that. If you downloaded from the internet, I've seen a lot of the contracts where there's still breakage clauses in recording contracts. But you're talking CPDs, and these are things that are taken that are being charged to the recording artist or to the music publisher, because just because they're standard and they've been there for 50 years.
You know, can you describe what that means for those who aren't familiar with?
Back in the days of vinyl, if you could deliver only so many and then some would break, you know, as they say on cereal boxes, you know, things may shift or break in transit or in shipping, and those would be deducted from the advance given to the artist. And that is still in some of the standard major record label things today, and that goes to the cost. Ultimately, it's passed on to the consumer.
How does that wouldn't apply at all.
No, not that's it's just ridiculously silly because you're online.
And yet that cost is being factored into the contract negotiations.
Sure. And a lot of the cost is a lot of recording artists are really unhappy about this nowadays. So what they're doing is in the recording contracts, they're ending up spending. I mean, the recording companies are putting up a lot of money for touring and stuff, but a lot of the artists, if they're better off, obviously the starting artists can't do anything. They have no control over what goes on and never see a cent, I shouldn't say never, but usually never see a cent of income after the advance. They're doing their own concerts, and now they're doing merchandising, and they have all sorts of other methods for raising the money other than the actual music.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where the money seems to be now, because it doesn't seem like that many entities are actually making money off music.
What do you see in a few minutes that we have left, kind of a sum-up type question, but what do you – I mean, we've discussed fair use, which I think we can at least both agree is going to remain to be a hot topic, as technology advances and as these issues are hammered out. But if you were to identify two or three issues that you think are going to be on the front burner in the next few years, what's your sense of what they would be in the entertainment world?
I think one of the big deals that doesn't get a lot of publicity, but is behind the scenes, a lot of clauses in contracts are arbitration or alternate dispute resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of the legal world and how it affects our clients, arbitration and mediation is rising. And I think that will cut down on costs because you're going to see less litigation. And I think that's something that's gaining momentum. Obviously, like you said, the fair use. I think, you know what, there's so many hot-button topics. I'm trying to think, well, the orphan works have to be resolved somehow. I think that, I mean, you put your finger on initially. Licensing itself is so confusing, and there are so many entities involved that some system needs to work somehow. It's just a question of how to get there and what entities need to be involved and who's on top of it. There are a lot of ideas out there about what to do, but nobody's ever tried it yet. You know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is the funding out there? Is the technology out there? The biggest deal that I see and that I've seen in the past, you know, 5-10 years and that will continue to be, is that technology moves at a faster speed than legislation or litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And technology will continue to define the agenda of what the issue is.
And that seems to be, you know, at the end of the day, so many of these issues boil down to, I think, that in fact are basically boiled down to economies of scale. And that 30 years ago, I couldn't discuss a mashup with you unless I had an enormous amount of equipment and time and resources. And now you can do these mashups on pretty much any laptop or desktop computer that you buy. To me, when you have economies of scale impacting how the law operates, I think that there's a problem with that. In other words, the law should be able to stand independently as having merit without respect to how many violations there actually are or what the violations are. If it's good for one situation, it should theoretically be good for another. And I think as the scales continue to tip back and forth, it's going to be a real struggle for all interested parties to figure out where that balance should lie. As I talk about this and listening to what you were saying, you know, I again, the show being recorded on October 20th, not too far from where I live is a Tower Records. And Tower Records is going out of business and being liquidated. And, you know, Tower Records
would have been unheard of 10, 15 years ago. years ago.
Exactly. And for anyone that who was near Tower Records, in all likelihood, bought a fair amount of CDs there if they had any interest in music. They always had a very wide selection, I thought, of music, stuff that you wouldn't normally find in other stores. And it was, you know, it was a great chain. And simply because of the change in technology, I think, more than anything else, it's a difficult business model to maintain.
I think Blockbuster's having the same issue.
And, right, exactly. And, you know, then you look at, in fact, I'm going to be having on my show, by the time this show airs, it'll probably be coming up and, it'll, may have already happened, in fact. But by the time the show airs, I'll be having Stephen Levy, who's come out with a book on the iPod and how the iPod has changed not only culture but the music world. There's a lot of, you know, the technology is ultimately, I think, where the battleground lies and why there are debates about the scope of fair use and things like that because, again, of the scale of it. So it's a fascinating discussion, and I'm glad that you were able to come on today after some logistical issues here at the studio have the discussion. I want to give you the opportunity before we close. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about these issues?
Well, you can learn more about these issues, obviously, by going to the website for the Copyright Office, the U.S. Copyright Office. You could check out the Entertainment Arts and Sports Law page of the New York State Bar Association. You can contact me directly at ehekeresk, that's ehekeresk, at yahoo.com, or give me a call at 914-478-0457.
Alyssa, thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you.
When we return from the music break, I'll do a short close, and we'll come back in just a few minutes. I've tried on the show to play some music that, like I said, is not getting as much attention as I think it deserves. There's another album that I would fall into that category. That's Justin Sullivan's Tales from the Road, off the album Navigating from the Stars. I want to thank Alyssa Hecker for being on the show today and really engaging in a spirited discussion on these copyright issues. Like I emphasized when I was chatting with Alyssa, and emphasize again, the purpose of the show is really not to convince anyone of anything as much as it is to basically educate. And these are issues that I certainly have strong opinions on, as Alyssa does, but they're issues where reasonable people differ. And I encourage you to not only take a look at the Copyright Office page as well as the web page that Alyssa mentioned for fair use, but also to check out the CIS's web page, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and the work that we're doing at CIS, and really educate yourself on these issues and form your opinions accordingly. I'm really happy to have Alyssa on to discuss this stuff. By the time this show is on the air, I hopefully will be able to say that you can check out the audio portion of this show by going to any number of places. Our iTunes webpage is up and running and will have the audio, as well as the website for the show, which have recently been launched at www.hearsayculture.com. Again, that's www.hearsayculture.com. And as always, you can also go to my blog at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and not only learn about what I'm doing and what's going on with Hearsay Culture, but also the work that everyone's doing at the Center for Internet and Society. You're listening to Dave Levine. This has been Hearsay Culture. Stay tuned for further programming on KZSU FM Stanford, and I look forward to talking to you next week.